pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Thank you very much, Scott, for that introduction. Well, welcome, listeners, to episode 3. I am Trevor, a.k.a. the Iron Fist. With me is Scott, a.k.a. the Velvet Glove. And you're listening, of course, to the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. How are you going out there, Velvet Glove? Should I be calling you Velvet or Glove or Scott? What do you want me to...
I don't think we're that controversial that we have to completely disguise our identity. So
okay, all right,
entirely
it's
up to you.
Okay, it's going to be Scott. How was your week? And as a fully fledged podcaster now, you're feeling the love from the public?
Oh, look, absolutely. You know, here we are. You know, it's so far so good. It's only been certainly the release has gone global because it's now on the iTunes store. But I imagine that the downloads are probably still in the single figures at this stage.
Yes, I think there would be. I think there's a couple of ways of measuring success in this sort of venture that we're in, Scott. One of them could be Facebook likes. And if we were to do that, we're currently up to 8. On that score, so
yes,
we could do better.
Rome wasn't built in a day.
Yes, that's true. And another one might be if we were to measure the number of people we've potentially offended, that might be another.
I am truly looking forward to our first bit of hate mail.
Well, some friend, you know, I was discussing with some friends and. Last week, I think I might have set a standard that will be hard to beat in terms of potentially offending people because at the last count, Scott, I think I may well have offended Tony Abbott, George Brandis, the entire German banking system, Liberal Left, the Indonesian police force, Nick Kyrgios, and 1.6 billion Muslims. So I think that's going to be hard to beat.
Well, you know... Rushdie got himself a fatwa, so that could be a measure of success too. Okay. You know, if we end up with a death sentence over at least one of our heads, if not both, that could be something to aspire to.
Right. Hopefully, they won't take us too seriously.
One would hope not.
In terms of criticism, you know, one of the things that one of our aims, on this show, we've got a few of them. You know, something for young people to talk about on weekends, and you know, giving something a little interesting insight. Another one would be, I think, Scott, to sort of set the agenda for the week. You know, when people are talking about stuff, then if we could set the agenda of what people are talking about, and I think I succeeded in the week that's just gone by because you will recall in episode 2, I mentioned a young man called Nick Kyrgios and gave him a bit of a bagging, and everyone's jumped on the bandwagon.
And you've got that Australian icon, Dawn Fraser, in a world of hurt too.
Yes. So I didn't mention Dawn, but I certainly mentioned Nick, and people have jumped on the bandwagon. And I watched a little bit of his match with Gasquet, and I don't know whether he pointed to God at the end of the match in a thanks for that sort of gesture. I kind of doubt it, but... Anyway, that's
he may well have taken your constructive criticism on board and decided that end of match prayers were no longer appropriate.
Yes, he might have, but I tell you, somebody who did take our criticism very well, and that was Tony Abbott.
Is that right?
Yes.
Did you hear from the big Kahuna himself? Did you?
He called. You'll probably find this hard to believe, and. I managed to record the call, and for your benefit now, I'm going to play it to you, Scott.
And to all our listeners out there, here is an exclusive from the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
The Iron Fist and Tony Abbott, and here we go. Prime Minister, thanks for calling. I must say, I am surprised. I understand that you've listened to the podcast, and I guess I'm wondering what do you think of the work that we're doing at the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove in trying to raise awareness about secular issues.
You are helping to build a strong and prosperous economy in a safe and secure Australia.
Gee, thanks, you make it sound so serious. But you do realise that one of our aims is to point out how stupid so many of your policies are.
You have a heavy responsibility.
Of course, we will be looking very carefully to see if you have any good policies or ideas. I mean, we'll be looking very carefully, and we will tell people about those if we can find them.
You have a challenging job.
Yes, I think we do. Well, thanks for your call. And do you have any final message to Scott and I, bearing in mind the secularists that we are? Anything that you'd like to say to just sort of motivate us on forwards, onwards and upwards, that sort of thing? Anything like that for us, Tony?
May God bless you. May God bless your work. May God bless the country you are helping to protect and prosper.
So there you are, Scott. I don't think he quite understood the secular nature of the wishes I was hoping for, but Tony Abbott, a pretty good sport, I would have thought.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I've got to admit, with that God bless your work and God bless Australia, I was waiting for, you know, hail to the chief at the end of it all, but was not meant to be. Perhaps we'll get a call from the White House at some stage in the future.
Yes. So obviously for people who have been, you know, watching the news at all, our fearless leader Tony Abbott was swearing in the Border Protection Force, and that those words he used there with the God bless, God bless, God bless, were part of that ceremony. And it really, he must have almost tripped over his words and said God bless the United States of America in there, because gosh, it sounded like something that you would get out of the land of the free.
Well, frequently those presidential addresses do end with God bless you and God bless America. And, you know, when he was God bless your work and God bless Australia and that sort of thing in that particular launch of the Border Force, it was very reminiscent of a presidential address. I don't think there'd be an awful lot of people that would have picked up on it, but other than, I imagine there'd be a few people probably sitting in the bar shaking their head. But, you know, it's...
fellow secularists would have, you know, certainly my ears pricked up, and I thought, my goodness, what have we become? But...
He's been the first in my memory anyway that's invoked God as much as that. I mean, I remember... There was a Geraldine Doogue interview of John Howard when they were trying to get a fix on him, and she asked him about his religious views, and he said that he was a Christian and that sort of stuff, and she asked, well, do you pray? And he says, well, that's a private matter, so I don't need to disclose that. So, yes. You know, in that respect, John Howard was far more secular than this one, because this one's more than happy to have it out there in the public and... try and get some runs off it.
Yes.
You know, I thought Howard handled it when he was asked the question. I thought it was a lot better than the way any of this lot would handle it. And I've got to say, Kevin Rudd disappointed me too once when he, you know, had a doorstop interview on outside a bloody church. And I thought, God, is this, you know, Canberra or is it Washington?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I mean, we obviously will over the years be... passing various comments about Tony Abbott, but I think he's going to be the gift that keeps giving, Tony. He's just going to keep, in terms of, you know, a secular-based podcast, I think Tony Abbott's going to provide plenty of material for us.
I think that's a very good way to describe him. He is the gift that keeps on giving, and, or the gaff that keeps on giving, one of the two. It's almost like it was that leadership spill was a practical joke.
Yes. Yes.
And no one really thought anyone would take it seriously. Well, you know, here it is.
Yes. Speaking of a gift that keeps on giving, Barnaby Joyce. Would you like to tell the listeners? Would you like to launch in a bit of a spiel about Barnaby for us?
Barnaby is to Australian politics what your drunken uncle is to your wedding reception.
Mm.
And this week, I think, was particularly good. I mean, most times when Eric Abett stands to his feet and starts talking social policy, the only people that are brave/stupid enough to join him are Corey Bernardi. But that didn't stop the Minister for Agriculture. This week he jumped in, boots and all, with them and said that, you know, his ministerial colleague, Minister Betts, had a point about that we should be looking after the Asian sensibilities when it comes to same-sex marriage, because the Asian people that we are trading with might see a decision like that as decadent.
Yes.
Which begs the question, has he ever been to Patong Beach, particularly Bangalore Road in Thailand? Because that is what I imagine Sodom and Gomorrah probably looked like before God destroyed them. Similarly, I'm told that there are some fairly risque places in the Philippines.
Yes.
And given that the expose by Animals Australia about the treatment of cattle being slaughtered in Vietnam with hammers rather than knives and that sort of stuff.
Yes.
I thought, well, you know, and Minister Joyce was concerned about Animals Australia trying to stop the live cattle trade to Vietnam.
Yes.
And I thought, considering that he had listed Vietnam as a growth market for Australian beef, I was wondering if he was aware that Bloomberg Business, which is a publication that I'd never known about online, I'd never seen it on the Bloomberg television on Foxtel, but they had this is a report from January of this year, January the 8th, that Vietnam was changing its marriage laws to no longer explicitly outlaw same-sex unions.
I think I saw something about Japan as well, perhaps I couldn't comment on that.
Japan always has had a reputation as being one of the more conservative parts of Asia, so I don't know. Yeah, I couldn't comment. But I thought it was somewhat interesting that a communist government in Southeast Asia, that, you know, the tourist books used to advise you if you're going there, don't wear shorts because you might look like a silly Westerner, was prepared to move faster than Australia was.
Look, and before we go too much further with it, Scott, I'll just interrupt because I've got the actual quote here so that people who haven't actually perhaps heard it or read it to see exactly what was said. But the coalition Senate leader, Eric Abetz, said that front benchers who could not support Liberal Party policy should quit their positions and argued Asian countries had not joined the global march towards same-sex marriage. So basically he was saying Asian countries aren't doing it, so we live in Asia and we shouldn't. And Joyce on the ABC Insiders program said, I think that what we have to understand is that when we go there, there are judgments, whether you like it or not, that are made about us. And there they see in how we negotiate with them, whether they see us as decadent. Now people say, well, that's outrageous. And it sort of goes on. And then asked whether they would see Australia embracing gay marriage as decadence, Joyce said, I think that in some instances they would, yeah. So between Joyce and Abetz, they're basically saying we shouldn't have gay marriage because of what Asian countries will think of us.
Well, by that logic, then, shouldn't we also, you know, polish up the gallows and reopen them to hang people?
It's just frightening. I mean, this is the sort of thinking that's going on. As I keep saying on the Facebook page, if they're getting these decisions and this sort of thinking so obviously wrong, what about all the other stuff that we don't hear about that they must be mucking up?
Well, you'd love to be a fly on the wall in cabinet to actually see how they arrive at these positions, because it makes you wonder whether or not, you know, do people like Julie Bishop and Malcolm Turnbull just sit there and put their head in their hands and think, my God, what have I done?
Yes.
You know?
There's a fellow called Rodney Croom, who's the National Director of the Australian Marriage Equality Lobby Group, and he said Joyce's claim was irrelevant. He made a very good point. He said that, you know, if you're going to worry about what people think of us or if you're going to compare us to other countries, he said the relevant international benchmark would be countries that were closest to Australia in law, history, culture and language. And he cited New Zealand, Canada, the UK, the US and Ireland, all of which have marriage equality.
Mm.
Good point.
And now I remember many, many moons ago, former PM and Paul Keating, when he was asked about Asia, because it was, let's face it, it was under the, initially under the Whitlam government, and then more forthright under the Hawke and Keating governments, was the push into Asia. And he was asked once on a news broadcast, are we an Asian nation? He said, no, Australia geographically is in Asia, but we are not an Asian nation. Mm. Now, you know, what we've lost, it seems, in 20 years is the ability to try and explain something that's a little more controversial and explain to people that, yes, geographically, this is where we live, but we are not the same.
Yes.
And I thought that was a very good point that could well be, you know, again, used here in this particular situation. But the thing that struck me about that was that it seemed to me that the conservatives within the party were scrambling to try and find some sensible reason to say no other than just because.
Yes.
And, you know, and when you don't have logic on your side, you come up with the most ridiculous positions, and I think that's a position that Abetz and Joyce have arrived at, is a ridiculous position.
Indeed.
And so I can't for the life of me understand why they seem to enjoy swimming against the tide, I think. And I think Coombe was dead on the money. He says you should look at countries that are closer to us in values and history, and
yes,
everybody else that, you know, is part of the Commonwealth.
Who cares what other countries think anyway? Like, just do what is the right decision. And even if, I wouldn't care if New Zealand, Canada, the UK, US and Ireland all thought we were wrong. You don't do things because of what people will think of you. You do them because also, it's the right thing to do.
I think that Joyce fundamentally doesn't understand business in that, and let's face it, the Asian business culture, they will do a deal with you if you've got the right product at the right price.
Of course now, they will.
And they're not going to give two hoots as to what people may or may not do in the privacy of their own home and whether or not they've got a certificate from the government to say, yes, this is us.
I mean, the notion, you know, we're negotiating over some container ships of sheep or iron ore or whatever, and at some stage in the negotiations they're going to go, I'm going to squeeze you for a few, you know, a few extra on this because of your attitude to... Because you guys have gay marriage? Just a joke.
It was a joke, yeah. It's the last desperate attempt by a group of people that know they're on the losing side of history, and they are desperately trying to stop it from happening, and it's just not working for them, and they're just looking more and more ridiculous every time they come up with it. You know, in a similar vein, I wrote to my local member... and I had a response from him, which was sort of saying, oh, well, he's... Because I wrote to him and just said, look, this is just ridiculous. You know, do you guys like swimming against the tide? And where the earth is it?
So your local member is a coalition?
He's an LNP guy, right, yes. Yeah. He's a coalition guy. Ross Vaster is his name, for the member for Bonner. And I can't find the exact email. I can't find the email, so I am paraphrasing. If Mr. Vaster is listening, I apologise if I get it wrong. But he did write back and said, well, it depends on which... of course, it depends what bill it is, whether or not it's this genuine attempt at a cross-party bill, which is the one that they all seem to be throwing the brakes on, or is it the one that Bill Shorten threw together to try and cause us dramas? Well, clearly, the bill that's in the media is the one that's been written by Warren Entsch and backed by... why can't I remember the young lady from the... Who's the member for Griffith? What's her name? Anyway, she's a Labor member. Mm-hmm. And then it's also got cross-party support from people like the independent Cathy McGowan, and then you've got the independent for the Tasmanian seat, and you've also got the Greens deputy Adam Bandt in the House of Reps and so on and so forth. So it is actually broadly based...
I just don't buy legislation. Why it matters... where the bill originates. Like, what's in the bill? Are the ideas in it good or bad? Who cares where its birthplace was? Like, who cares?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I understand that point of view, but this one here, I mean, surely this is their last, you know, the excuses always were, we've got to have something that the Parliament owns. Well, now we've got something that's got broad cross-party support, so why is it that, you know, the PM can lean on that committee, which names, the name escapes me, but the committee decides what bills actually get debated.
Mm.
And have you noticed there are a number of people that have fronted the cameras and said, oh, well, you know, it's so very rare for private members' bills to be debated anyway. So they're setting it all up for failure.
Yeah, they are.
Now, which is just going to make them look silly. Mm. It really is. Because, and this argument that it's going to need a week to debate, nonsense. Mm. It's, you know, this is something that really... You know, you could just say to any of the speakers, you could say to them, look, you've got your 5 minutes, then sit down and shut up. We've got to get this done quickly.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's a national emergency to do it, but the public clearly wants it. If there is a problem with it holding up other important work of government, then cut the debate back. You know, let people like Corey Bernardi grandstand, but anyone else that's in support of it, just stand up and say, this is an equal rights issue. That's why I'm voting for it, and move on.
To be honest, it's such a simple concept that it's... I don't think there's a lot of debating topics in it. Like, I think they could get through them in time, but there's one other person I want to point out in this whole sorry saga, and that would be Scott Morrison, who is reported as having appeared on the Bolt Report. There we go. We're quoting the Bolt Report now, and... this is what he was saying about the passage of gay marriage reform. He said, this is Scott Morrison, I think those who are proposing the change underestimate the sort of change that this entails. And if you talk to the many ethnic communities across Australia, the linkage between their strong beliefs, and it doesn't matter whether they're Christian beliefs or Hindu beliefs or Muslim beliefs, and the connection between that and their culture is very deeply felt. They're a voice that I don't think we've heard a lot of in this debate, and what the change means for them. We are a multicultural country, and that means respecting culture in this question as much as in any other. So, essentially, Scott Morrison is saying that gay marriage reform is going to upset... Well, he says Christians, Hindus and Muslims, perhaps, and they need to be consulted more and about what the change means for them. Has anyone explained to Scott Morrison they're not going to be forced to marry, you know, okay, Muslim men are not going to be forced to marry other Muslim men if they don't want to.
No,
like, if they can...
It's not going to be compulsory.
I think he thinks it is. Like, you would honestly, if you were reading that, you would be thinking that it must be compulsory. But whatever happened to the concept of letting people do what they want to do, provided they're not harming other people? Like, because some Muslim or Hindu cleric says, oh, we're uncomfortable with that, we don't want other people, atheists perhaps even, men marrying atheist men, we're going to be uncomfortable. Like, as if we should be halting, having even a discussion about that sort of nonsense. That just irks me, and I can't believe that you can make... I mean, he can make a statement like that, and nothing like that in the media. Nothing comes out in the media. You've got to really look hard for this sort of stuff. It's an outrageous thing to say, and yet you get away with it. It's amazing what you can get away with in Australian public life, saying things like that.
Well, I don't understand why it's an issue for faith-based organisations, because it's already been... The latest bill had an accommodation in it that said that churches that feel uncomfortable with this will not have to bless same-sex unions.
Exactly.
Now... Today I read a report, and it was one of those that I printed out and promptly left at the office. Sorry, listeners, so I can't reference it. But it was from the Presbyterian Church, the church that the Velvet Glove grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that they are considering not having legal marriages performed in their churches anymore if you end up going down the road of having same-sex marriage.
Yes. Now,
that really wouldn't worry me because, quite frankly, that is an exceptionally good example of what secularism actually is that the legal stuff that the government requires will be done by bureaucrats.
Yes.
And the holy stuff that the church wants would be done entirely separately. So I think that's a very good separation of the church and state. So yes. If anything, we should be encouraging the Presbyterian Church in that direction.
Yep. I won't be protesting in the street if they decide to give away the marriage game in the Presbyterian Church. That's okay.
No. My understanding in a lot of places in Europe and is that when you get married in Italy, is my understanding, you go down to the bureaucracy, you sign the paperwork, you make your legal declarations, and then you go out to the church at some future time and get married in front of the family and in front of the Holy Family. Mm. So, to me, I think that I don't see that as an issue. But so, if they want to do that as a protest, they've actually just proved the point for me.
Yeah, but you did right. I did see that article, and it was a discussion about whether they were going to pull out of the marriage game because of what has happened to the thought of marriage in Australia if gay people are allowed to marry. But Scott, we mentioned, I think Nick Kyrgios could become a bit of a mascot for our podcast. I saw a headline in the paper, and
perhaps we should write to Nick and let him know that he's really impressed us.
Look, depending on his mood, he could be really good about it or really bad.
Really angry. He could well be our first piece of hate mail.
Yeah, he could tank on us. You know, not that he ever has, not that he ever has before, but he could. But there was a headline in the newspaper in the sporting section which said, "You cannot be Kyrgios," which was a reference, of course, to John McEnroe, who used to, in his tantrum, say, "You cannot be serious." And this was "You cannot be Kyrgios." And I think we need a little segment called "You cannot be Kyrgios." And to kick off that segment of sort of disbelief would be this time. Look, you have to, you know, one thing about us, Scott, is we're getting across the religions, and the Catholic Church I'm up to on this one. Mm-hmm. So the Catholic, well, it kind of related to the gay marriage question because in certain newspapers there were ads where 150 businesses put their names and logos on the ads saying that they supported marriage equality.
Yeah.
Nice little
and
gesture.
And these weren't small businesses either.
No, there were some, like, Microsoft and Google and people like that, I think. Is that right? Or of that sort of ilk, that sort of size. Anyway, as reported on the 25th of June, the Catholic Church in Sydney sent letters to the companies expressing its grave concern about their stance. And some of the things, well, one of the letters they wrote was to Maurice Blackburn Law Firm, and who promptly then provided it to the media. So one of the things it said, "It is with grave concern that I write to you about the Marriage Equality for Australians campaign." Goes on to say, "For corporations to speak on such issues is indeed overstepping their purpose and is to be strongly resisted." So this is the advice from the Catholic Church to Maurice Blackburn.
And so lawyers aren't allowed to discuss social issues in public.
Well, it was kind of, you know, are they trying to intimidate this firm or not? And then later on in the letter, it says, "You may be aware that the Catholic Archdiocese of Sydney is a significant user of goods and services from many corporations, both local and interstate." Like, there's clearly an implied threat here that we're going to withdraw our business from the people that we see on this sort of list. Like, a threat from the Catholic Church saying, A, you shouldn't be commenting on social issues, and B, we've got a lot of purchasing power, and, without saying it, but implying that they might withdraw that purchasing power if they didn't like the fact that these companies had done this.
Well, you know, I mean, if I suppose I personally would not like to be in business and have a client that was involved in covering up sex crimes, for example.
Yes.
And when one of those people was, one of their principal employees was involved in covering up those sex crimes and then used very brutal, ruthless legal techniques to try and protect themselves from prosecution, and then got promoted for his efforts and moved to head office on the other side of the planet.
Yes.
I'd be concerned about being involved in business ventures with an organisation that was doing that.
I mean, so often, the gall of the Catholic Church knows no boundaries. I mean, so often it is the pot calling the kettle black with them. So the first part of what they've done here is they've said, you know, corporations shouldn't be speaking on these sorts of issues, and it's overstepping their purpose and to be strongly resisted. So, gee, I hope that the Catholic Church would never, in its practice, have, you know, overstepped its purpose, gone beyond the boundaries of what it's supposed to be doing. Yet they do.
Well, I'm reminded of what it was like when you were growing up, was when the bishops used to tell the faithful how to go and vote on the weekend.
Yes. I mean, well, they do all sorts of things. Like, I wrote a press release for the Secular Party. I don't think we ever released this one. It's sort of got a bit of dust. I dusted it off, and one of the things I was talking about was the way that religious commentators get a free run to commentate on anything in the media. And a couple of examples I gave was ABC Radio National Religion and Ethics Report, 8th of April.
Actually, yeah, that's not a bad show, actually. I quite enjoy that.
Yes, it's good material in that. 8th of April 2015, where the United Church's Dr. Mark Zernsack was interviewed about tax dodging by multinational companies. No.
Oh, wasn't that hilarious, too?
No mention, of course, about how the Catholic Church being exempt from paying taxes is the ultimate tax dodger. So, you know, Uniting Church on ABC Radio talking about tax dodging. Then you've got, there's another one where there was a Catholic priest, Father Paul Kelly, and an Anglican Archbishop, Dr. Philip Aspinall, giving their 2 cents worth about the scrapping of the gay panic defence in Queensland, which is a criminal law defence. And, I mean, it had nothing to do with the Anglican Church or the Catholic Church, but they're putting forward their views on the gay panic defence. And while I agree with their view that it should be scrapped, you know, the thing they should have been talking about was, like, marrying gay people rather than, because that is something that is within the boundaries of things they can control and deal with, and yet here they were sort of commenting on legal defences. And I thought, that's...
Well, if they commented it from a point of view of saying that every human life is sacred, I might be disagreeing with you, but if they were making a legal opinion rather than a moral opinion, then I think they have overstepped the bounds.
They have no special skills in the area to do that. But, you know, so by all means, enter the debate if you want to. I mean, Scott, you and I are entering debates where we're certainly less than expert, but don't tell other people that they can't enter the debate.
We're not theologians, are we?
Well, we're not at the same time telling other people that they can't enter the debate, like the Catholic Church has done with these corporations and has said, well, you know, don't get involved in gay marriage promotion, thanks very much. I mean, it's just, I mean, if we're going to talk about something, we'll know a little bit about it, Scott. Like, we may not be experts. We've done a little bit of research or enough to sound like it, but, you know, Catholic Church, it would be like celibate priests giving marriage or contraceptive advice. Well, I mean,
they do all the time.
They already do. So, So that's my you cannot be Kyrios moment for this week with the Catholic Church up in arms with businesses who dare to give a social opinion. telling them to stick to their knitting when the church is very guilty of getting involved in all sorts of side issues that aren't strictly religious.
One of the beauties of living in a liberal democracy is that you are free to choose the services that you buy and from whom you buy those services. So if the Catholic Church does feel uncomfortable dealing with companies that have put their name to a social issue like equality of all citizens before the law, then they are free to deal with others. But given the number of companies that are actually on that full page ad, there's not a lot left out there in the market that's, where the bigot can feel comfortable shopping.
Yes. I think if the Catholic Church wanted to use a computer or the internet, they're going to struggle to avoid using that list at some point, so...
Well, there was a very funny, and this was just a Facebook meme, but it had listed the tech companies that were in favour of same-sex marriage in the United States.
Yes.
And it was your Facebook, your Microsoft, your Apple, and all that sort of stuff. And then it said, it was pointed out to the American Christians that had called for boycotts of these companies, and they said, well, if that's the case, if you want to boycott companies that are in favour of same-sex marriage, then you're going to have to stop using Facebook to sprout your bigotry.
Yeah.
Yeah, or something like you can't type on your Windows machine or your OS machine on Facebook to sprout your bigotry.
Yes.
So I thought that was somewhat amusing.
Yes. All right. Next topic, Scott. Did you have one you want to put in, or I'll just charge ahead with what I've got?
Well, we've got a very quick one here from the home of the free in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court in the state of Oklahoma has ruled 7-2 in favour of removing a 6-foot-tall stone monument to the Ten Commandments on the grounds of the Oklahoma State Capitol.
Yes, yes.
So, the home of the free is moving further out into secular territory than we are.
Yes.
Anyway, like I said, it was just a quick one.
Yep. This one might take a while. I mean, surely the whole issue of Indigenous affairs, we could wrap up in 15 minutes, Scott? No, I want to...
Well, that's probably what's been the problem with it, is that everyone's tried to fix it in 15 minutes and it's failed.
Yeah. So I want to initially talk about Noel Pearson. And first of all, I'll give a little bit of background and then I'll give a little bit of opinion. But
sure,
as you know, we've just had a meeting of Aboriginal leaders with the Prime Minister and the opposition leader, and they've been discussing what to do in terms of Aboriginal affairs and the Constitution and stuff like that. So, first off, in relation to Noel Pearson, whenever I've heard Noel Pearson in the past, I've quite liked what he's had to say. What about you?
Yeah, and 2-3 weeks ago, there was a meeting up in, I think it was up in Port Douglas, and I remember hearing what he had to say, and he was bang on the money. He talked about how you have to have economic engagement. He said that the only way races, and that were his word, not mine, but the only way races have ever moved forward was to be involved, to have some economic ownership and that sort of stuff.
Yes.
And he says, he also had made the point in the past, and I can't reference it, but I am sure it is him, that he said that oftentimes there's what they call white fella guilt, that they think that they can, assuage their guilt by throwing welfare at us, and that's no good for us.
Yes.
So, that wonderful Indigenous term for welfare, which they refer to as sit-down money, I think it was Pearson, I apologise if it wasn't Pearson, where he said that it's actually that ruins us.
He's been very scathing of certain elements in the Aboriginal community who are wanting handouts, and...
Yes,
and
I've always been very impressed with what he's had to say. I thought he's, I imagine this is a different kettle of fish, though, because some of the stuff I've heard come out of him on this particular issue, I'm not entirely sure I agree with him.
Yeah,
so I'll let you go.
Well, what he said on Q&A a few weeks ago, and what I've read in this article, is that as part of constitutional change, he wants an all-Indigenous body, elected by Indigenous people, to be able to make representations in federal parliament. So he wants a separate little Indigenous leaders group to be ensconced in federal parliament who can make representations to the government. And
so tell me, Trevor, does his plan give them a voice or a vote or both?
No, he said that he was quite specific on Q&A about this, that it was just a voice and that the government could choose to ignore that voice, didn't have to accept it, but there would just be a voice. And he was very clear about that. And that's an important element of where I'm heading to next, because this conference, or this little get-together that they just had with Aboriginal leaders. I'm not sure if it was Kirribilli, was it? It was Kirribilli on Monday, and Tony Abbott was there, and Bill Shorten was there. And Noel Pearson said that it was a good start, it was stage-managed, and it left a bitter taste in his mouth. He said that the way forward had already been nutted out between Mr. Abbott and Mr. Shorten prior to the meeting, but they both did a very good job of pretending to listen. So he wasn't happy that they were just pretending to listen. And I thought to myself, well, this whole proposal that you've got to have a group of Aboriginal leaders who are in the parliament, who can say stuff which is just a voice but doesn't have to be listened to. If you don't like sort of talking and having people pretend to listen to you, then the thing that you're proposing to happen in federal parliament is going to be an unpleasant experience for you, because that's what's going to happen.
Well, either that or they'll use it as an excuse to do something. Like, one member of it will say something that's way out of, you know, right out there, and someone will jump on it and say, well, the member of the advisory body has told us we should do this, therefore we think we should do it, you know. And the other part of it, I'm not comfortable on having any sort of laws that concentrates on what makes us different.
I agree entirely, Scott.
I would like us to be concentrating more on what makes us the same. You know, the 99 point whatever percent of the DNA we all share.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And look, I mean, don't get me wrong. A prick of a thing was done on the 26th of January, 1788.
Yep.
You know, you can't defend what was done. You know, it's wrong to come in and use overwhelming military might to displace another group of people from the country they had inhabited mm-hmm. for tens of thousands of years. Mm-hmm. But you know what? It happened.
Yep.
It was terrible, and there's no way in hell that Europe's going to take you or me back.
Yep.
You know,
I agree with you. I am really uncomfortable with anything that tries to establish a special class of people within our society. Like, our first objective.
I'm not saying no, but what I am saying is I want to know what the full implication is going to be.
Yeah.
And hence why I don't know if you saw the interview on Sky News on Sunday with Warren Mundine. Warren Mundine. He mentioned that there were other Indigenous leaders that had a stronger view than he did. His position on constitutional recognition sounded a hell of a lot more palatable, because it didn't appear to be creating a different class, as it were.
Right.
It was just more or less adding the story of the country prior to this 26th of January, 1788.
Okay, I'll get on to the... Save the preamble.
I'll let you finish.
I just want to finish with Noel Pearson. So there was that issue in terms of wanting a group who get to say stuff but don't have to be necessarily listened to. And, you know, day one of this meeting, that happens to him and he's not real happy about people pretending to listen. So he's in for a world of pain there. But just there's some muddy thinking going on in Noel's head. He's gone on to say that, I have this great hope that my children are going to be Australians. They're going to participate in the political life of this country unrestrainedly. At the moment, for example, we're characterised as a race, and it affects our whole psychology, not just the black fellas, the white fellas too, because the white fellas think we're a separate race and treat us as a race, and we ourselves have internalised that. So he's acknowledging that there's a real problem in character, being characterized as a race and being separated, yet he's still advocating change.
Wouldn't that committee create?
Yes.
Wouldn't that just enforce that perception?
That's what I would have thought. I think it's really, like, I've liked what I've heard from Noel Pearson in the past, but, you know, to admit that we should be shouldn't be characterized by race, therefore more homogenous, but then be wanting to set up special stuff for a certain race just defeats that whole thinking. So I don't understand.
I don't think it's... if the ultimate goal is to have recognition of Indigenous people in the Constitution, then if you create a separate body like this that, yes, has a voice, not necessarily a vote, you're giving something... You're creating a target for the naysayers to throw rocks at.
Yes. Yep.
And hence why I think that... you know, if the ultimate goal is recognition, then I think he'd be wanting to dial it back a bit.
Mm.
Now, I suppose by having this constitutionally recognised, that would stop a future government doing what Howard did and dismantling ATSIC, wouldn't it?
Well, who knows? I don't know that that's the case. It depends on what is said. What they're looking at... You know, there's talk about the preamble to the Constitution, putting in a recognition of somehow of Aboriginals as the first inhabitants of this land, and not sure what else in terms of what it's going to say. And I explained to people that a lot of people are under the impression that a preamble has no legal effect, that it's just some background information that has no consequence. But in fact, if an act of parliament is ambiguous in its interpretation in any way, then a court can look at the preamble for guidance as to how to interpret sections of the act. So a preamble can have legal effect. So it's not like it's just window dressing. It, depending what it is, it could actually affect the interpretation of the Constitution. So it's not just a harmless commentary, unless you specifically say in the preamble, you know, here's the preamble, and by the way, we specifically state that the preamble should not be used as a guide for interpreting the substantive provisions in the Act. So I'm kind of thinking I might need that if I'm to agree to something in the preamble.
Well, I mean, first up, just forgive my ignorance, but do we actually have a preamble in our Constitution?
Yeah,
wasn't that...
Yes, and you'll be...
We do.
Yeah, okay. It does refer to one person, and I'll give you one guess as to his name.
That would be the monarch of the United Kingdom, I think.
No, well, actually... She or he might be there. God is in the preamble.
Oh, is he?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So God is currently referred to in the preamble, and there's been different constitutional committees over the years that have looked at the Constitution, and there was a recent one 15, 20 years ago, and Constitutional Convention met in Canberra in February 1998.
I remember that constitutional convention.
Yep, to consider whether Australia should become a republic and what the constitution would say, etc., etc. And part of the recommendation was in the preamble. Number one, it should refer to Almighty God. So I stopped reading at that point. I thought, if I got the first line wrong, is the rest worth reading? But anyway, so God gets a run in the current preamble, and in the most recent review, he was still getting a run. So we need the secular party in power urgently, Scott, to stop that happening. But just back on, before we leave Aboriginal affairs, and look, on the secular party website, we've got a forum for members, so listeners out there, If you are at all interested in secular affairs, become a member of the party and you get to participate in our forum. Anyway, under the old forum, I put forward some stuff, and one of them was that I visited the art gallery in Brisbane, and in the lobby was an Aboriginal tent embassy saying all sorts of stuff about you stole our land and blah, blah, blah. And I made the point on the forum. I said, the forum, the topic eventually got round to Sorry Day. Sorry Day, I think first one was about 15, 16 years ago, something like that. And Sorry Day was aimed at the stolen generation. So saying sorry for that. And it's an annual day every year where symbolically white people say sorry for the stolen generation. And I said in the forum, look, if you must do this, then I reckon about a week later, or maybe the next day, or even the same day, we should have, in addition to Sorry Day, we should have Apology Accepted Day, or It's Okay Day, like where the Aboriginal community says, fair enough, on this issue, you have given a genuine apology, you've done what you can to repair the damage, apology accepted. And I just said, if in ordinary individual-to-individual level, if I apologise to you over something, Scott, and then every year on the anniversary, you expect me to apologise again, at some point I think to myself, well, aren't you ever going to accept this? Aren't you ever going to accept this apology? And
at some point you'll tell me to get stuffed.
Yes. And if we've got other issues that haven't been resolved, then I might think to myself, well, why would I bother apologising if you haven't moved on from this other issue where I genuinely made an apology? And I made the argument that if we really help the relationship between Aboriginal Australia and white fellow Australia, if they would at some point accept the apology.
Mm.
And it's a bit like the whole Islamophobia type of thing. I got some really harsh responses in there, and I said, look, I'm not suggesting for a moment a single dollar less goes to Aboriginal programs or whatever, like not wanting to stop anything, not wanting to change any of that. It's just Aboriginal people, it'll be good for them to move on. It will help encourage white Australia to make further apologies and do further things in relation to other stuff beyond the stolen generation.
Well, I think it'll also help in getting people moving on from the words and into practical and into practical ways to actually improve the lot of Aboriginal people.
Hmm.
I mean, it's a bloody disgrace that we've got a significant minority of our population living the way they tend to do.
Hmm.
And it's a disgrace that it's a disgrace that in some parts of a developed nation like Australia, they live like they do in southern Sudan.
Yes.
You know, and But
it's not for want it's not for want of effort or money. Some problems are just intractable.
Yeah, and that's and a critic would tell you you're being defeatist, but let's face it, a lot of money has been spent over multiple decades, and we really as a nation haven't achieved an awful lot with it.
Mm.
And Noel Pearson made that exact point up there in Port Douglas a few weeks back. He said that, you know, you're talking about billions of dollars being spent on an annual basis. And he said, and I think his exact words were, what have we got to show for it? You'd have to say not a hell of a lot.
Yes. Yep.
And that's a damn good point, you know. And so hence why I count myself as a skeptic about when Rudd was giving the apology in Parliament. I thought to myself, well, this isn't going to achieve anything. It's pointless. It'll just open us up to litigation. Well, I was wrong.
Mm.
But what I wasn't wrong about was I don't feel it has actually achieved anything in a practical sense as yet.
Yeah.
And I think that we've got to move from beyond the symbolic onto the practical side of things. And I think part of that way would be for significant leaders of the Indigenous people to actually say, we accept your apology.
Yeah.
And again, it's just symbolism, but if symbolism is important, then I think that symbolism goes to both sides too. And, you know, I'm an accountant, and a reconciliation is to bring two sides together to find the common equal fact. And so far, if reconciliation is to be achieved, it's got to be more than just one side saying, we did the wrong thing over the last 200 years. It's all our fault. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea grande culpa.
Yes.
And I think the other side has to then move some way to say, we accept your apology and, you know, let's all live together and embrace our common humanity.
Exactly. And let's work on treating just everybody equally. And when people are, when we're all in this together on equal footing, I think it will work better. But, Scott, I didn't mention, and I should have, but that meeting with the Aboriginal leaders, with Tony yes. Abbott and Bill Shorten, at some stage yeah. during the meeting, the Bill Shorten and Tony Abbott had to leave the room, and the Aboriginal leadership was there on their own. And I was fortunate enough to record that meeting, and I'd like to play that for you now.
From our fathers. Yeah. From our fathers. And what have they ever given us in return? The aqueduct. What? The aqueduct. Oh, yeah, that's true. And the sanitation. Oh, yeah, sanitation. Remember what the city used to be like. Yeah, well, I'll grant you, the aqueduct and sanitation are two things around the dagger. And the roads. Well, yeah, obviously not roads. I mean, the roads go without saying, don't they? The park, the sanitation, the aqueduct, and the road. Irrigation, medicine, education. Yeah, yeah, all right, fair enough. And the wine. Yeah, that's something we've really just made in the Romans left, the public baths. And it's safe to walk in the streets at night now, Mitch. Yeah, it's certainly not hard to keep order. Let's face it, the only ones who could in a place like this. All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, the fresh water system, and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us? Brought pennies.
So you can see, Scott, they were speaking in code there. For some reason, instead of white fellow Australia, they were saying Romans. And I'm not sure who Reg was amongst the leadership there, but, you know, that's just a bit of an insight as to what was going on. Look, obviously it wasn't. It's from the life of Brian. But, and you know what? Wouldn't it be great if they were having that conversation? But they're not. Like, white fellow Australia gets no credit for anything. That's part of what grinds the gears of non-Aboriginal Australians. So a little bit of concession as to some of the good things that have been done would be nice.
Well, some of the good things that have been done, and a concession to that would actually stop the likes of Pauline Hanson ever getting any oxygen.
Yes.
You know, clearly what she was saying was wrong. I don't defend her in any shape or form, but you can understand some of the resentment that has built up over many, now hundreds of years. Probably 4 to 5 decades is when, you know, there has been the sort of industry of guilt has been rolled out. And I do think that it's giving rise to people of the extreme right, particularly your Andrew Bolts of the world and that sort of stuff, they are getting ammunition given to them.
Yeah, will probably accuse me of being extreme right on this issue, but honestly, I'm not suggesting for a minute less help for them. Of course, there are some communities in a terrible plight, and let's help them because they're in a terrible plight, not because they're Aboriginal. And let's do it for the right reasons, not just because of race, but because of predicament. That's why we should be doing things.
because they're members of the same human family that we are,
yes.
And the, you know, that's what we should be doing to our brethren human beings, is giving them a decent accommodation, decent healthcare, and a decent education for their kids.
Yes.
Not because of what happened on the 26th of January 1788.
Yes. And so just to be clear to all the people out there who are just going to say, oh, you know, what a terrible, harsh line this is. There's nothing harsh about it. It's not meant to take any welfare away. It's just it is actually looking at ways of improving the system, and one of those is for Aboriginal people to face up and admit some of the good things and to accept the olive branch that has been offered.
You know, where our Kiwi cousins are fortunate, if I may put it that way, is that because there is only one Maori language,
yes,
they can have gestures like,
yeah,
you know, official greetings being made in Maori as well as English. Yeah. They can have gestures like kids in being taught in primary school the Maori language, that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it would be nice if we could do that. Maybe there can be, maybe the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate can be taught some phrases in Aboriginal languages from that area to say at the opening of Parliament instead of the Lord's Prayer, maybe have some Indigenous words spoken. I don't know, you know, and I did like the fact that the Rudd government did have a, you know, Indigenous involvement in the ceremonies that opened Parliament. I'm not sure if that's continued with this current government or not. I imagine it would, considering, you know, Abbott is actually genuine about the issue. Mm. But, you know, those sorts of symbols, and yes, they are only symbols, but they're also powerful symbols.
Mm.
That if your Parliament is opened with a smoking ceremony, for example, then that says to me that it's more than just... It's powerful symbols more than just, you know, two dozen speakers each standing up and saying, I pay my respects to the elders of the whatever people, both past and present.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that when it's forced on like that, it just becomes a very sort of mechanical thing. But if you actually go to the point of having Aboriginal dancers and the parliamentarians walking through the smoke of the eucalypt leaves being burnt, I think that's far more powerful as a symbol than anything else.
I agree. So anyway, yeah. I'm sure in future there's a lot more that we'll be covering on the Aboriginal issue, but the main thing was just Noel Pearson's comments and the sort of constitution amendment proposals that I wanted to cover, because that's what's happened this week.
Yeah, I mean, if someone said to me tomorrow, if someone said to me there's a vote tomorrow on constitutional recognition, which way are you going to vote? I'd have to say I don't know.
Mm.
I would want to be certain that we are not creating a potential for a whole busload of lawyers to make a lot of money out of a lot of lawsuits. So I'd have to be certain that we were doing something that wasn't going to have wasn't going to have a downside for anyone and wasn't going to cost us a fortune in the courts.
Yeah.
And also something that wasn't going to create a different class of citizen.
Well, according to...
And that could well be just fear. I don't know. Mm. But I don't think I'm educated enough on the issue to make a solid judgment yet.
According to a Fairfax Ipsos poll, 85% of people support the constitutional recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as Australia's first inhabitants. So I
suppose that then comes back to, you know, your point you made before about if you have it explicitly saying that the preamble is a story and doesn't have an impact on the Acts of Parliament.
Yes.
Then if you were to have that, then I'd be more than happy to vote for it.
Yes.
I am the first to admit that perhaps this is just fear talking, but I don't know what the implications would be. And, no disrespect for the legal community, but I don't really want to be creating a hell of a lot of billable hours for yourself either.
Yeah. I'd certainly want any recognition or commentary to sort of refer only to what happened when white men first arrived, sort of a recognition of that takeover of the land, if you like, I'm less reluctant for it to talk about what current Aboriginal people's relationship is with the land and acknowledging them as current custodians and, the, you know, recognising their special relationship with the land and that sort of thing, because I don't think it's true for 100% of Aboriginals. They can't all think and be the same.
Well, that's starting to border on the supernatural then.
Yeah, and the sort of inherited sort of rites passing through I'm uncomfortable with. So I'm sort of leaning towards something that recognises what happened historically to Aboriginal people at that time, but less inclined to support things that sort of preach about their current unique association with the land that might place them above and beyond other Australians. That's the part that worries me.
No, look, I mean, it's noble that we're moving in that direction, but we've also got to make sure that it's not going to be something that can be easily pulled apart in an election, well, in a referendum campaign. You don't want it to be too divisive. Mm. And if people do feel threatened, then scare campaigns work very, very well. Mm. And that was the point that Mundine was making on Sunday morning. He said that it's much easier to mount a no case than it is to mount a yes case. Mm. So I do think that whatever way the country goes, we have to make sure that it can be something that unifies the country, not divides.
Yes, yep.
And hence why I'm sceptical about having this advisory body that must be made up of Indigenous people, elected only by Indigenous people. Mm. And I think my initial reaction is that just concentrates on what divides us rather than what unites us.
Mm. Yep. Scott, we did receive, I mean, Tony Abbott was very favourable. Yes. And we're not sure of Nick Kyrgios what his reaction is, but we did get one negative piece of feedback, and it was from a great Australian, and she wasn't happy with us. Dawn Fraser, when asked her opinion about the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove, well, this is what she had to say.
They're being ill-advised by their management, and you know they should be setting a better example for the younger generation of this country, about this great country of ours. If they don't like it, go back to where their fathers or their parents came from. You know, we don't need them here in this country to act like that.
Well, the problem with that, Scott, is my parents, they were born here. And I think their parents before them. I don't have many options. What about you?
Well, I had one grandmother arrive here. One grandmother arrived here when she was very, very young. I don't think she was actually born on the journey over, but she wasn't. She was born not very long before they actually boarded the ship, and they left from Kilmarnock in Scotland.
Yes.
And then the other side, my dad's side, arrived here on the last fleet of convicts to be deported from Britain. And at that stage of the deportation program, if you were sentenced to 7 years or more, you could voluntarily choose deportation to the colonies.
Right.
And our side, he had started to hear rumours about how that you didn't do your full sentence, and when you got released, you got an acre of ground and all the rest of it. And he thought, well, anything's better than an English jail. And he was sentenced to 7 years for pinching a halfpenny, which is half a penny.
Yes.
And he served 5 years, and in that 5 years, someone took him under their wing and taught him how to read and write and all that sort of stuff. And hence the decision to voluntarily go to the colonies turned out to be much better for him, because if he'd got out of an English prison after 7 years, he probably would have been in the workhouse, and that would have been about it.
Yes. You know? So
So that's how we got here.
Yes. Well, there you go. Well, Tony Abbott is happy with us. Nick Kyrgios, we're not
sure.
Dawn
Fraser thinks we should go.
And Dawn Fraser, we'll have to do better to keep Dawn happy. So, and of course, Scott, we'll mention that while we're both members of the Secular Party, the views expressed in the podcast are certainly not necessarily the views of the Secular Party, and they're simply the views of Scott and or Trevor. Often, actually, I say things which might be a bit more outrageous, and just because Scott doesn't necessarily disagree doesn't mean he doesn't disagree, if you follow my meaning, because he's just being polite. And so in a couple of years' time, when he's running for Parliament and, you know, they bring out something outrageous I've said.
And they dig this up.
And they say that, well, Scott, why didn't you object to that? Well, the answer is, folks, that if he was to interrupt every time and clarify, you know, perhaps he doesn't quite agree with me 100% on whatever is said, then we would never get a podcast complete. So the outrageous stuff I'm certainly happy to take on board as mine. And if Scott says something, he says it, but just by associating with me, not necessarily. So there you go. There's all the disclaimers for episode
three. That's all the disclaimers I'll ever need, isn't it?
And look, just assume that disclaimer carries on for future episodes. There you go.
Okay, all right. That's fine.
All right, everyone.
We're done.
So thank you for listening.
Thank you, listeners, for joining in.
Thank you for listening to episode three of the podcast of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. And keep track of us on...
Enjoy the week ahead.
Keep track of us on Facebook. We're currently at 8 likes. If we could get to 16 next week, Scott, wouldn't that be good?
It better be nice than if we could aim for 100% growth rate each week. We'll take the country over in a month.
Alrighty, thank you everybody, and goodbye.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.